Chapter 4. Vice President of Disadvantaged Neighborhoods. "Did you book the suite like I asked?" Bernie, the importer who worked in soap and shampoo, had just come to Shanto, and we were scheduled to meet Sister and her husband, Amin, at the Regency Hotel that afternoon. To set the tone for some rather important negotiations that Bernie had planned, he asked me to find the largest suite available. "The hotel had turned its entire top floor into a single residence," I told Bernie. "They called it the Presidential Suite, and it was not commonly rented, but was instead reserved for Communist Party officials and other VIPs." "It sounds perfect," Bernie said. "Make sure you get it." Only after much prodding did the hotel give me a price on the suite. It rented for more than a couple $1,000s per night. It was obviously too much, but when I told the manager why we were interested in the suite in the first place, he offered to make it available at no charge. Hotel managers in South China were often like that. If they thought you were helping the local economy, they made all kinds of concessions. Before Sister and her husband arrived, Bernie introduced me to his company, Johnson Carter. The company had never been a manufacturer in the United States, as I had assumed. It was a virtual company, and, as a consequence, it was not one of those companies that was directly moving American jobs offshore. Bernie had created an opportunity for himself that was based on a newly found ease in offshore manufacturing. He handed me his company catalog while we waited downstairs. Johnson Carter manufactured a variety of healthcare products. Flipping through the catalog, I saw a number of items that were familiar to me, including the bubble bath, a line for which we had just begun to produce bottles and print labels. There were three varieties of bubble bath. We had a purple, grape-scented product that was branded Galaxy Grape. Another one that was red was called Crazy Cherry. And the pink formulation was marketed as Bursting Bubblegum. The labels for all three were decorated with cartoon bubbles filled with little smiley faces. Turning more pages, I saw dozens of other products. Johnson Carter had a line of hair conditioners, hair gel, and body lotions. There were also many different kinds of liquid soaps. One line came in a bottle shaped like a seashell. Another in a round bottle had a pump. A banner along the top of the label for one read, "Wow, only 99 cents. The soaps advertised 55% more, free. Sister and Amin arrived at the hotel and were escorted to a main room on the top floor, in the middle of which sat a white grand piano. The curtains had been opened, revealing a view of the quiet city. Sister said that she was surprised. She had been to the hotel many times before, but said that she was unaware of the expansive suite. Before we sat, Bernie asked if anyone would like to see his new catalog. Sister said that she was eager to, and she asked questions while flipping through its pages. It was the sort of brochure meant for prospective customers back in the United States, but she was taking it as a production guide. "We can make all of these," she said. "That's great," Bernie said. Sister then asked questions about a few products. On the front of some bottles were pictures of fruit. She knew what the apple product was supposed to smell like, but she had questions about the bottle that showed an apricot. Another that showed an avocado elicited additional questions. These were fruits unfamiliar in South China. All the same, Sister said that it would not take her long to get duplicates made and samples sent off to New York, where Johnson Carter was headquartered. Bernie found his way to a cream-colored sofa, and the rest of us took places on pieces of furniture spread about the large room. We sat so far apart from one another that everyone was forced to shout to be heard. The business was about to kick off in earnest, and pricing negotiations were the main reason why Bernie was back in China. Sister said that she had received messages from Bernie regarding price targets, and that she was optimistic that the factory would be able to meet them. It occurred to me for a moment that the idea to meet in such a luxurious suite conveyed the wrong message. Bernie was pushing for low prices. Even if we were allowed to use the suite for free, it made Bernie appear affluent. I thought it would have made Sister and Amin reluctant to agree on low prices, but quite the opposite effect occurred, and they were enthusiastic about moving things forward. "Tell them I have big plans for their factory," Bernie said. Sister and her husband heard this and smiled. Coming downstairs from the hotel suite, Bernie carried a large case of samples to the lobby. Though he insisted that he did not need any help, Sister and her husband together lifted the heavy case into the trunk of their car. We passed a number of factories in the drive from Shanto to the outskirts of the city. Bernie noticed that the billboards on the side of the road did not advertise soft drinks, cigarettes, or other consumer products, but mostly heavy machinery. At an intersection on the way were several billboards cluttered together, many of which advertised plastic injection machines. Sister and Amin's company, King Chemical, had something to do with the plastics industry. It had once produced plastic components for toy companies in the area. Shortly after moving on to supply the cosmetics industry with plastic bottles and caps, the company went on to build a business that had them filling the bottles with care product ingredients. It was King Chemical's way of moving up the value chain. The road to the factory was full of tractor trucks hauling 40-foot containers, those long boxes filled with manufactured goods for export. The four-door Honda that we rode in competed for space with these tractor trailers, as well as with large delivery trucks, buses, and taxis. The few other sedans that could be seen on the road were mostly high-end luxury cars. Despite all the talk of a rising middle class in China, there were relatively few private vehicles on the road. The traffic was two-tiered, much like the Chinese economy itself. Bernie remarked on the traffic, saying that he could not believe how busy the place was. For him, it was sensory overload. We were not even halfway to the factory when he asked me, "How can you live here?" I laughed, not because I had gotten used to the traffic in South China long ago, but because it was an especially odd comment coming from someone who was asking me for help. The truth was that I called it home. I felt comfortable there. "The place has its moments," I said. Reaching into his jacket pocket, Bernie brought out his airplane ticket. He was going to be flying out of Guangzhou in just a couple of days. It was the city where I lived. Shantou, where the factory was located, was a 50-minute flight away. Bernie looked at his ticket and for a second appeared puzzled by it. "Let me ask you a question," he said, looking suddenly serious. "Sure." "Now, where the hell is Canton?" "Canton is the old name for Guangzhou." The city had been a major trading port for over 1,000 years, and for hundreds of years the city was the only point of contact between China and the outside world. The interest that the city was seeing in trade was nothing new. In fact, it was a historic return. I wanted to tell Bernie some of this, but sensing a history lesson, he changed the subject. Tourists had a more enlightened view of China. Business travelers saw the place as merely a backdrop to their business transactions. Bernie had little patience for information that he considered beside the point. To him, cultural lessons on the place, or the people, were like so much static, red noise, that did not illuminate as much as interfere with an otherwise clear signal. Inside his briefcase, Bernie had a pile of orders in process, as well as a number of important potential orders. This was what he was focused on. He wanted to know what King Chemical could make and whether they could reach certain price targets. Beyond that, he wanted to know about delivery times and whether quality would be up to standard. Importers rarely wanted to know about history, just as they didn't care about macroeconomic trend data. Close to where we would turn off the main road, onto the street that led to the factory, we passed a truck that was carrying pigs. Bernie was an Orthodox Jew, and he made a fuss about the truck, pointing in its direction. At first, I thought he was offended by it, but he was instead amused. "Did you see that?" he asked, laughing. "One pig was humping the other." I strained my head back to look at the truck, which we had just passed, but could only see that it was overloaded. Sister saw how excited Bernie had become and asked if he liked pigs. The word for the animal in Mandarin, zhu, was pronounced like jew in English, and this caused a moment of confusion. Bernie guessed that Sister was asking about his religion and his dietary restrictions. On his previous visit, just before I came into the picture, Bernie had turned down several offers to join the factory for dinner, explaining that there were certain things he could not eat. Given the importance of feasts and banquets in the courtship rituals of Chinese business relationships, it was a slight embarrassment, but it did nothing to slow down talks between the two companies. This was something of a surprise to me, actually. Having spent years living in China, I was sufficiently acculturated to believe that it was impolite to decline business-related invitations. Chinese do not differentiate between business and personal relations to the same extent as Westerners, and their concept of face required that certain signals be delivered elliptically. Refusing an invitation could be taken the wrong way. Some of Bernie's habits bewildered me also. Though Jewish as well, I was not observant, and while I understood something about Orthodox customs, Bernie had habits that were unfamiliar to me. Coming out of the bathroom, I had seen him throw an arm over his head while mumbling to himself. At first I thought something was wrong, and I asked what had happened. He explained that it had been a small prayer, one that was recited after using the toilet. It was not his arm that he meant to get above his head exactly, but any piece of cloth. He needed to cover his head when reciting the prayer. He did not typically wear a head covering, a kippah, like other Orthodox Jews, which was another thing that I did not get. "It's a Syrian thing," he said. It was the first time he indicated to me that he was a member of the famed Syrian Jewish community, and it at least explains some things. For Bernie's Chinese business partners, anyway, the mumbled Hebrew prayer, the sleeve over the head, the polite refusal to eat certain foods, these were all likely rolled up with a dozen other behaviors that made him seem strange, but these did nothing to dampen their enthusiasm for the business-related opportunity. At the end of the day spent together, Bernie wanted to tour the factory again. He had not been back to the plant since his first visit, and he reiterated an earlier concern that workers were still labeling plastic bottles by hand. He said that he had seen a labeling machine at another factory, and he wanted King Chemical to purchase one. Sister assured him that the workers could apply the labels fast enough, and that hand labeling had the advantage of being more accurate as well. If the workers were not labeling fast enough, the factory would just hire more people. The machine was expensive, she explained, and labor in China was cheap. "But tell them that our orders will be large," Bernie said. Sister said, "Please tell Bernie not to worry." It was not about efficiency, though. Bernie envisioned the factory as appearing more up to date. He said, "I can't bring customers to a factory that looks like it's from the Dark Ages." When Sister understood that Bernie worried only about what it would look like, about what his customers would think, she exchanged glances with her husband and they spoke for a brief moment in the local dialect. Together they nodded slowly. Sister said that actually they had been thinking of buying a labeling machine for some time, and that they would have one installed. The idea of the labeling machine itself had not interested the couple, nor had satisfying Bernie's demand for a certain kind of equipment. However, the idea that such a machine would impress Bernie's customers struck a chord. In pricing negotiations with Sister and Amin, Bernie mentioned the names of customers that he was working with. "I knew the companies. They were some of the largest drugstore, supermarket, and dollar stores in the United States." Sister and Amin had never heard of them, though they would soon enough understand the significance of these retailers in the American market. Bernie explained that he needed low prices. If certain targets and pricing were not reached, he could not close some deals, and the volumes were large. "The price target for some of the products was already too low," Sister said. "On each item, there was a great deal of back and forth, and nearly 2 hours was spent discussing the pricing scheme for body wash alone." Sister and Amin suggested that they needed higher prices if only because they had a small factory. "We have little money," Sister said in heavily accented English. "It would be worth it," Bernie said, "to keep prices held low," and he talked up the larger business opportunity. "Pricing might be a challenge in the short term," he said, "but the factory would do well for itself, and the effort would be worthwhile." "I hope so," Sister said in a way that made her appear sad. Bernie talked up his industry associations. He said his partners were Syrian Jews who had connections at all of the major supermarkets, drugstores, and dollar stores. Once merchants in the New York area, the Syrians had long ago moved on to do international trade. The owners of some retail chains were of Syrian descent, and others had gone on to work as buyers at publicly traded retailers. It was a sales pitch that any Chinese would have made, a promise of business opportunity made possible through personal connections. Sister and her husband strained to understand Bernie and what he was saying. They didn't understand English, but they hung on his every word all the same. Bernie predicted that within a few short years he would have one of the largest health and beauty care companies in America. It was a bold claim, but when the translation was offered, Sister and her husband appeared as hopeful as Bernie did. Bernie tried to keep the meeting light. He made occasional attempts at humor, but these almost never went over well. While his jokes were not understood, when he laughed, Sister and Amin laughed too. At one point, Sister had a question about some of the formulations for hair conditioner. Bernie said that he did not have an answer and that he would have to get back on it. "Tell them I'm just the boss," Bernie said. This was not a sentence that a Confucian would understand. In China, no company president would ever confess to such blatant ignorance. The boss would certainly not claim to be merely the head of the company. When we were dropped off at the hotel in the evening, Bernie told Sister and Amin that we would one day rent the suite at the top of the hotel for real. There will be room enough for all of us to stay there, he said. Bernie was in a good mood, and he was surprised by how well things had gone. In the lobby of the hotel, he impulsively threw an arm around Amin, who was nearly swallowed inside his large, lumpy frame. Bernie laughed, and in an aside to me said, "Look, he's so small, I could almost put him in my pocket." Sister looked at me, waiting for a translation. I asked Bernie for a rephrase. "Tell him that he's like my little brother. Go ahead, tell him that." Amin heard this and grinned sheepishly. It was not the shy smile of someone deflecting a compliment, but an expression that suggested that the words had been taken right out of his mouth, that he would have delivered the line if only he had thought of it first. "Tell Bernie I feel the same way," Amin said. Having released Amin from his bear hug, Bernie next put his arm around Sister's neck. Her hair had been put up, making her appear about as tall as her husband. "Tell her, if I wasn't already married." Seeing Bernie laugh at his own joke, Sister asked what he had just said. It was a phrase I didn't know what to do with, and I was embarrassed to the point of speechlessness. "He said that he looks forward to working with you." Sister spoke very little English, but took the opportunity to answer Bernie directly. "Me too," she told him. After the meeting was over, Bernie said that it was time for the two of us to get better acquainted. This was an odd American habit, to do business first and only later take the time to find out who you were working with. In China, they did it another way. First you met and got to know someone, and only then did you talk business. In the hotel bar, Bernie ordered a bottle of Black Label. A cocktail waitress in a tight dress came over with the bottle and a stainless steel bucket of ice. I tonged out the ice cubes while he poured the whiskey. "This business is going to be huge," he said. The trip had been a success, he declared, and then he remarked how he was surprised that everything had gone so smoothly. In the end, the factory had given him nearly everything he had asked for. "My wife isn't going to believe it," he said. "Bernie told me about his family, about his children who were already grown, and about one of his sons who was also working with him in the business." While we drank, Bernie began to scribble out numbers on a notepad that he had pulled out of a bag. He looked at his notes and adjusted his glasses. "Let me ask you something. How can they make this stuff so cheap?" It was an interesting question because shampoo was a particularly unlikely candidate for importation from China. The formulation itself was mostly water, which made it extremely heavy and thus expensive to transport. The 40-foot containers we shipped had a weight limit, which we would always reach long before the space had been filled. For a bottle of shampoo that cost 30 cents in China, we expected to pay more than 15 cents just for the ocean freight. Bernie was talking out loud now. "I know this business, and I just can't figure it out," he said. He ticked off items from his piece of paper. "Plastic bottle. Pump. Label. Formulation. They can't be making anything on these orders. How is it possible?" It was just as much of a mystery to me. "The factory seemed motivated to work with him," I suggested. "Maybe that was reason enough. This notion that the factory wanted desperately to work with him personally appealed to him." He went silent while looking over his sheet some more. Other foreigners I would work with would have a similar reaction at the start of their China projects. Everyone back in the United States had warned them about how difficult it was going to be to do business in China, but just out of the gate, they had proven these doubters wrong. Bernie was not so much mystified as he was proud of his accomplishment. Importers would arrive in China and have this feeling. They had not only found their way, but they had single-handedly managed to slay the dragon. The whiskey and the ice disappeared quickly. The cocktail waitress came over and refilled our ice bucket. She was thin and tall, with sleek long hair, and Bernie remarked on the tight outfit that she wore. It was a hotel uniform that was traditionally inspired yet modern, and it complemented the girl's figure well. When she had gone, Bernie asked if I dated local girls. I told him that I was in fact dating a Chinese woman, Maria, back in Guangzhou. He rolled his eyes. It was, he said, something that he would like to help me with, only he didn't know any single girls who were Jewish. He only knew Syrians, as in Syrian Jews. Except he didn't call them that. He referred to them as S-Y, pronouncing the letters like they sound, S-Y. The expression was said as though it were a code of some kind. It took me a while to catch on to the shorthand. He referred to Syrian Jews as S-Ys, and non-Syrian Jews were referred to as J-Dubs. The notation came from the two consonants in the word Jew. I had heard about the Syrian Jewish community before. Their association was especially tight, a Freemasonry of traders. Later, I would realize the extent to which many other trading groups operating in China were bound together by ethnic ties. The Russians networked together, the Arab traders too. Even the Japanese that I would see at trade shows appeared Yakuza-like. These groups were clubby and heavily networked. More often than not, they were wheeler-dealer types, with a souk sense. They knew on instinct how to barter. These groups stuck together because they had to. It was how they gathered information on the marketplace. There were no how-to manuals or schools that offered training on working with overseas suppliers. There were tricks of the trade that had to be learned, and in order to prevent shenanigans, or to engage in them, a successful trader had to have access to a knowledge base of some kind. Learning from the experience of veterans was less expensive than learning from your own mistakes. Bernie was proud of his SY connections, and he spoke of the Syrian community with a great deal of reverence. He surprised me next by explaining that he had not always been religious. When he was a young man, he had left the community and only later in life had an awakening of sorts. It was only sometime after he became religious that he found his way into international trade. It was important to Bernie that I knew where he was coming from. Close to the end of the bottle of whiskey, he told me the story of his very first business venture. While still in school, he had an idea to sell watches. He took a train from Brooklyn, where he lived, to Manhattan and found a jeweler that was selling watches for a bargain price. He found another shop that produced boxes that were attractive. The box cost me more than the watch. And then he went to a man in his neighborhood called Mark the Printer, that's what we called him, and he had some certificates made up on parchment paper. I had business cards made and called myself the Vice President of Disadvantaged Neighborhoods, Bernie said, and I told them that I was specially authorized to give credit. You see, no one was giving credit in those days, especially not in the neighborhoods where I was going with these watches. All they had to do was make the first payment, I told them. They could mail me the other three payments. The watches sold for $180, and each payment was $45. But I didn't have more than $20 in the whole deal, between the watch, the box, and the parchment. Bernie took a sip from his glass and looked to see if I was paying attention. You see, these guys that bought my watches, they all figured they were going to fuck me out of the three payments, but in the end, I made my profit on just the first payment. The story had the feel of one that had been told a million times, and I was aware that part of the point was to make a certain impression. He was playing the teacher, the savvy, streetwise guy who might teach a book-smart business school graduate how things worked in the real world. At the same time, though, he was making a point about business strategy, about how greed in a transaction could be used to your advantage. The story did make an impression, and it was one that would stay with me as Bernie and I continued to work together on the soap and shampoo project.